So thanks for joining, everyone. My name's Hattie. I work for the Race Equality Network. For those of you who don't know, we're an infrastructure organisation and charity working across Bradford, supporting grassroots organisations. And we have launched this series of talks for Race Equality Week. This is the third of five talks during this week. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from Amna Rahman on her Kashmiri background, and finally on Friday the staff of Kanafa and Tea in Town, who are Syrian refugees who set up that business. So those are the two still to come. Today we're going to hear from Danny Carter, who's the owner of Telgra Community on YouTube, on Nigerian history. And thank you all for coming, and please feel free to ask any questions in the chat. But we will hopefully allocate the last section of the talk for answering questions. Please keep your mic on mute if you've got any background noise, but feel free to put your camera on, Gage. Over to you, Danny.
Oh, thank you, Hattie. Yeah, hi, everyone. So I'll just introduce myself. Yeah, I've got a YouTube channel, Telgra Community, where we interview community groups in and around Bradford. This talk's not really about that, although I am using some of that to get some of the local history, some of those connections I've got. This talk's on Nigerian history, which has become quite a passion of mine recently. I am half Nigerian. I'm born in Bradford. My dad's from Nigeria. My mum's English. And I was always into history, but didn't really know anything about African history in general until probably the last 5 or 6 years. And then something dawned on me. Why don't I know anything about African history? I started looking into it and there's loads there. So I thought, I don't know about it. Probably a lot of other people don't know about it. So I'm really happy to have this opportunity to give this talk. So I'll get into it. All right, Nigerian history. So I'll start with a little bit of general information on Nigeria now, why it's a country you might want to be interested in. It was founded as an independent state from the British Empire in October the 1st, 1966. So it's founded by Britain. I'm not sure if everybody knows that. It's the largest country in Africa by population. There's over 200 million people there. It's got quite a big diaspora as well. It's hard to count, but possibly 15 to 30 million Nigerians. And if you want to include people involved in the slave trade, possibly even more outside of Nigeria, so an even bigger population than 200 million. So it's twice as big as countries like Egypt and Ethiopia in terms of population. It's also the biggest economy in Africa by quite a way. Lagos City on its own is probably the fourth biggest economy in Africa. It's a mega city of 20 million people, and the whole of Nigeria together is the largest economy by quite a way in Africa. The current capital city isn't Lagos. It's like most people think. It's actually Abuja, which is a planned city which was built in the late 1970s and 1980s, which is right in the centre of the country. Because as we'll get into throughout this history, Nigeria's got quite a tumultuous past with inter-tribal rivalries. And so Lagos is firmly in Yoruba territory, which is one of the big major tribes. And to, you know, ease the concerns of other tribal groups, if word this might lead to them dominating, they decided to build a city in the centre of the country, which wasn't really owned by any of the tribal groups. And so they did. So Abuja, it's quite a big city now, probably about 4 million people in Abuja. It's right in the centre of the country. One of the reasons Nigeria's economy is so big is it's a major oil producer, 11th biggest in the world at the moment. And it's one of those countries which produces a lot of oil, ships it out, gets it refined into like petrol and gasoline, and then imports it back in. So still got, but that's changing possibly in the near future. There's a major oil refinery being built by Africa's richest man, Aliko Dangote, which is going to be one of the biggest in the world and supposed to be able to provide enough petroleum and fertilizer for the whole of Nigeria. So we'll see how that works, but that's a mega project. And it's a very complicated country. There's lots of different tribal groups there. They are called tribes in Nigeria. But I think that gives the image to some people of like an extended family group living in a small village. But some of these tribes have got over 40 million people in them. So tribal groups are just like ethnic groups, just like, so it's almost like being Yoruba or being Igbo is like being English or Welsh or Scottish almost. And most of these tribes have their own language, which some are related to each other and some are quite distant to each other. So there's again, depending on how you count, over 300 languages in Nigeria. The official language of government is English, because it was a British colony and various other things. But actually, the most common spoken language, and like the lingua franca which people use to speak between each other, is Nigerian Pidgin, which is a sort of Creole language which mixes lots of local words with English words and some other words, kind of like Jamaican Patois or something, if you hear that. And use a lot of slang. So Nigeria history, where to start it? I mean, that's always a problem with history, isn't it? You can always keep going further back. In terms of like civilization, there's fossils which have been found in a cave at Iwo Eluru, which is in the west of the country. It was like a cave site 13,000 years ago. So there's been people there at least since then. Perhaps more interesting, there's a fossilized canoe found, the Dafuna canoe, near the northeast in Lake Chad, which is 8,000 years old. So it's currently probably the second oldest boat on record, and it's probably used to fish around Lake Chad. So there were people doing, you know, craft work and trades work as far back as that. Talk a little bit about the geography of Nigeria now, just so you've got an idea of what I'm talking about coming up. So in the far northeast, you've got Lake Chad, which is a major lake, and you've got various river systems flowing through this. There's several major rivers in Nigeria. There's Niger, which it's named after, and there's also the Komodugu in the north, which is another major one, and the Benue River, and they both meet. The Benue and the Niger River meet and lead down to the Niger Delta, which is where a lot of the oil refinery is in the south. And you see Abuja is right in the center. In the north, you've got major cities like Kaduna and Kano, which are quite ancient. And the north is mainly Muslim. I don't know if I mentioned this. Nigeria is an interesting country. It's 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. And that splits mainly the north is Muslim, the south is Christian. Obviously, it mixes a bit, but that's mainly how it works. And in the north, you've got the major tribal groups is the Hausa Fulani. That's the biggest one. In the southwest, you've got Yoruba. And in the southeast, you've got Igbo, and those are the three biggest tribes, and there's each about 40 million people in each. And there's loads of other tribes who are important as well, but those are the three biggest ones. And so that's just to give you, I'm going to be talking about them later, so I'll give you some idea of them. And the other really interesting geographic feature of Nigeria, and one of the things I sort of named this talk after, is you've got this plateau towards the centre of the country called the Jos Plateau, which is over 1,000 feet higher than the rest of the country. And you get a completely different climate there to the rest of the country. You can actually grow strawberries there. And they do. It's a major strawberry producing zone in Nigeria and stuff. And because of the way geological epochs work in Africa, Jos is where we find like the oldest settlements at the minute in Nigeria. Because in the Northern Hemisphere, we're familiar with ice ages, these periods of expansive ice age. As you get down to Africa, what you get is humid and dry periods. And in the humid periods, you get really dense forestation. You get very heavy rainfall, very sort of dense forest and rainforest form, which are quite difficult to inhabit. And the Sahara shrinks. We've been in a dry period now for several thousand years. And that's when the Sahara expands. But you also get some of this forested area turns into more savannas and grasslands, which are easier to inhabit. And because Jos is more elevated than the rest of the country, while the lowlands were quite heavily forested, Jos was more inhabitable, easier to set up agriculture and stuff. So the oldest civilization we sort of have in Nigeria is currently the Nok civilization, which is found in the Jos Plateau. Famous for its terracotta sculptures, so quite sophisticated craftwork. This is from possibly as far back as 1500 BC. And yeah, it's called the Nok civilization. It's named after this village called Nok, which is on the Jos Plateau. Another very interesting feature, they were iron workers. There's slag sites from the leftover of iron ore smelting. Going back 600 BC at one of these villages called Taruga. So there's quite a lot of these villages on this plateau. Not all of them have been explored archaeologically, but one of them is Taruga, and there's iron smelting there. And another thing we get the idea in Britain, we have this idea of historical periods going from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. That only really makes sense for like Mediterranean civilization. In Africa, you have the Iron Age before the Bronze Age. And it seems to be, in sub-Saharan Africa, the oldest ironworking sites in the world are all found in sub-Saharan Africa. So it seems to be currently that Africa entered the Iron Age before anywhere else. And they're not just found in Nigeria, but there's some sites found in the Congo going back 2000 BC, which suggests quite extensive trade networks, because the iron working process is similar all across sub-Saharan Africa. So it suggests somebody discovered it and it spread outwards. But it got to this part of Nigeria by 600 BC, considerably before Europe or China. And you do get bronze working in Nigeria, but it comes after iron working. So, not sure. I imagine we've got a very educated audience, but I know a lot of people still have this image of Africans sort of being hunter-gatherers using stone tools. That's really not true for the whole of West Africa. West Africa is urbanised quite early on and is making its iron tools very early on as well, before anyone else, actually. They also use stone tools. They're large grinding stones where they grind a lot of pulses. It seemed to be quite a vegetarian diet they had. You don't find many animal bones there. And it faded away in 500 AD. No one's really sure why, but like most groups of people, it probably didn't disappear completely. The artistic lineage that you can see there in those terracotta figurines, that continues on into the Yoruba kingdoms, which date to the 8th century. If you can see in the bottom, I've put a picture up of a wooden carving, and I think you can see in the facial features a similar artistic style to that older style from the Nok civilization on the Jos Plateau. But we're moving into Yoruba kingdoms now, which are in the southeast. They had their own religion, which was centered around the city of Ife, which is still a spiritual home of this religion. And that's the oldest center of power for these group of kingdoms. Their sort of political structure is their city states. And Ife is the most important one to start off with. But that later transitions to Oyo and Ibadan, which are these two different city states. And Oyo in particular has quite an expensive empire. As you get into like the Middle Ages period, as you get into the 11th century onwards. Oyo's based in these clearings in between the forest. It's sometimes called the Oyo Gap. And in the forest, you have the test fly, which kills horses. But in these clearings, you don't have this fly. And so the Oyo made extensive use of horses and cavalry, which in the more heavy forested areas of southern Nigeria, you couldn't actually use. So they have quite a sophisticated military system set up and based around cavalry, and this allows them to move quite quickly and dominate a lot of the surrounding area. So that's Yoruba kingdoms. Move on to a later kingdom, the Kingdom of Benin, and again, similar time period, founded probably in the 9th century, founded by the Edo people in Edo State, who were related to Yoruba. You'll see similarities in the language. The local ruler is called an Oba, by both the Edo people. You might have heard of the city of Benin. It's famous for these very big earthworks, which I've put a picture of in the bottom right-hand corner. And these are like fortifications, but it's not built with stone, it's built with earthworks. And believed to be the biggest in the world before the mechanical era, they set for 16 kilometers around the city, and actually outwards of 300 kilometers when you include the ones around the surrounding rural villages. And this was quite a major urban area of tens of thousands of people. Going back 1,000 years ago, big city, they got very prosperous on trade, trading ivory and later slaves, although we'll get more into that later, and palm oil. It was first visited by the Portuguese in the 1400s. They established a heavy trade there, and later the Dutch take over. And I've got a picture in the top right there by a Dutch visitor to the city in 1668, and you can see some of what the city looked like, the procession of people. So quite, as you can see, quite a big urban area. If you look into the top right of that picture, you know, it stretches on for quite a way. And it was described by a Portuguese ship captain in 1691 as Great Benin, which is what they called it there, where the king resides. It's large in Lisbon, he thinks. All the streets run straight, and as far as the eye can see, the houses are large, especially that of the king, which is richly decorated and has fine columns. The city is wealthy and industrious. It is so well governed that theft is unknown, and the people live in such security that they have no doors to the houses. So he gives a very glowing review of it in 1691. As we get later on, there's lots of British visitors who don't give it such a glowing review, but anyway, but this guy liked it. He gave it 5 stars in Yelp, maybe, in 1690. So what I'm trying to go through these kingdoms is that one of the things about Nigeria is there's not like a previous kingdom which controlled it all before the British created it as a colony. Like in India, you know, you can go back far back to like Ashoka the Great and stuff, and roughly what is territorial India now was India then. That's not really the case in Nigeria. You have these individual tribal and political states and kingdoms, and some of them are quite different. So we're moving on to the Kingdom of Nri now. And again, similar time period, that there could be more archaeological work done to date these more specifically, but they're all present at least from the 10th century. From the 900s on, all these kingdoms are present in Nigeria. This is an Igbo land in the southeast. They have a very interesting sort of government structure. Igbo people are famously, I want to say unruly, but that's almost got negative connotations, but almost egalitarian. They tend to have quite flat hierarchies and be quite difficult to control. And this is true of the Kingdom of Nri. It's ruled by like these priest kings and a traveling priest class. And so it's theocratic, but like the way it works is these priests will travel around and they basically control trade throughout the kingdom. So they'll go to a farmland and they'll do a blessing. And in return, the farmer will gift them some goods or some of their produce. And they'll also like adjudicate disputes and laws. They have a set of taboos, and anybody breaking these taboos will have to pay them a fine of a certain amount of goods. And then they take this, take it on to other villages and towns and stuff. So they sort of control trade, but through this set of spiritual practice, which have certain gifts and rights to given to them. It was believed to be founded by Eri, who's a descendant, a sky being, some sort of divine being, a man but God, sent by Chukwu, who's in traditional Igbo religion, is a traditional, is their supreme deity, but almost believed as like to be like the sort of the life force of the entire universe. He's not personified in Igbo religion. It's not a person. This is just some sort of force which seems to give movement to everything in existence. He's an Eri, so this is a traditional story. And he's these priest kings, not all of them claim descent from him. If you're viewed holy enough, you can be sort of elected a member of his class. So it's quite decentralized and there's not a lot of military power going on. They have their own calendar, 4 days in a week, 7 weeks in a month, 13 months in a year, based on their own spirituality. They've got a currency, Manila, which is bronze, copper, and gold coins, but actually more, I put coins here, but more commonly it's bracelets, and this is traded all throughout the southern coast of Nigeria. The Kingdom of Benin uses them as well. And interesting, this is not known even by scholars, I don't know, the Igbo people in the southeast had their own writing system, Ensibidi, which I've put an example of in the top right. You can see the symbols there. It's pictographic, sort of similar to hieroglyphs. Wasn't invented by the Igbo people, seems to have been invented by the Ikoyi people who were right next to them, further in towards like Cameroon, further towards the east of the country. But yeah, they've got their own system of writing, and they found this on pottery going back to the 5th century, so 1500 years. And so yeah, there's over 1,000 years documented of this writing system, and it's pictographic like the hieroglyphs in Egypt and several other written languages in sub-Saharan Africa. Almost all the languages in sub-Saharan Africa, written languages, seem to be pictographic. I'm not quite sure why that is, but definitely an area which could do with more study. I think there's a lot of history to be covered there if we start reading these symbols and investing more time into it. Move on to the north of the country now, to the Hausa kingdoms. And it's a series of city-states, again, like Yoruba kingdoms. It's referenced as far back as 872 by the Arab geographer Yakubi in his chronicles of the Sudan, which is what the Arab chronicles called all the sub-Saharan lands. It's listed there along with the Kingdom of Ghana, which people might have heard of, and the Kingdom of Kanem, which is, these are these two big ancient kingdoms in sub-Saharan Africa, and the Hausa kingdoms sit right in between them, and they both sit on the edges of this trans-Saharan trade network. After you get the Arab expansion out of Arabia, and they bring the camels with them, they're very quickly, there was already a trans-Saharan trade before, like going back to ancient Roman tribes, but this really booms it, because with a camel, you can get across the desert a lot easier. And so you've got these major kingdoms which sit on the end of this trading route, and they're trading gold across the Sahara and getting various things back. And the Hausa kingdom sit right in the middle. The most powerful state was Kano, which today is still a major city in the north of Nigeria, probably about 2 million people there. And because they're on the end of these trade routes and they're getting all this influence from these Muslim kingdoms across the Sahara and next to them, they become Muslim by the late 14th century. So at this time, in the south of Nigeria, Nigerians are still following their traditional spiritual practices. But in the north of Nigeria, they're becoming Muslim and starting to write in Arabic and stuff like that. So you've got another written language system with a lot of documentation in north Nigeria. And the picture here I've put, these are the walls of Kano. So again, you can see walled fortifications, which are still there today, constantly warring with each other, as kingdom city states seem to do. So that's the sort of, these are the kingdoms of the of Nigeria. There's more, but those are some of the major ones before sort of a major European influence. Move on to the slave trade now. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but there's three slave trades in Nigeria. There's the internal one, which is the slave trade between Nigerians, which again dates back, hard to say, but before European influence and before Arab influence to the north as well. There's lots of different kinds of slavery. I think we in the West, we hear slavery, we immediately think of American style chattel slavery. That's one style of slavery. There's lots of other styles of slavery. And in Nigeria, you get everything from slaves who are taken and used as human sacrifices and murdered, to slaves who become quite powerful, like slave soldiers. The Yoruba kingdoms, who I've touched on, they have quite a complicated political system. There's kings, there's an elephant who's something close to like a prime minister, and there's like a military council. And if the king doesn't keep these guys inside, it becomes quite a tradition. They can force him to commit suicide, and the tradition is he eats a poisoned parrot egg and commits suicide. So the king's got quite a lot of people to contend with. And in the 1700s, there's a series of these kings being forced to commit suicide, just one after the other, like year after year. And so this king thinks, I'm next. I need to weaken the power of these military councils. And so to do that, he starts employing a lot of Hausa slave soldiers in the cavalry arms, who are, because they're not loyal to these, they're not from these the same towns as these military chiefs, he thinks, you know, they're not going to have any loyalty to him. They'll be loyal to him. So they'll be loyal to the king, sorry, instead of these military chiefs, and that's a way of weakening these power. And so these become, some of them, quite powerful within Yoruba kingdoms itself, themselves. Think of something like the Mamluks in Egypt is a similar story, or the Janissaries in the Ottoman Empire. You get these slave soldiers who eventually become quite powerful. They never quite take over Yoruba kingdoms like they did in Mamluk Egypt or Ottoman the Ottoman Empire. But so there's a whole gamut of some slaves who don't want to say doing all right for themselves, but doing a lot better than other slaves, shall we say. There's a Trans-Saharan slave trade as well in Nigeria. And this, again, dates back to antiquity, before you get the camels there. There's a slave trade going all the way up into Libya. And after that becomes a part of the Roman Empire, as well. This is documented. Herodotus mentions this, describes Ethiopian slaves in Libya who were cave dwellers. He calls them troglodytes, and being traced around by these Libyans in chariots. Ethiopians, their word for the Greek word for black people, I think it literally means burnt, but you can find this word as far back as the Iliad, actually. It appears twice in the Iliad. So there are black people mentioned in the oldest forms of European literature anyway, but they're also mentioned by Herodotus as being slaves. And then there's the one we're probably most familiar with, the Trans-Saharan slave trade. And so I'll touch on the Trans-Saharan slave trade now. Like I said, it goes back, Herodotus is writing in the 5th century BC, so at least 2,500 years probably. And it continues right the way into the 19th century and possibly even reaches its peak in the 19th century with the Sokoto Caliphate, which is founded by a Fulani Islamic scholar called Usman Dan Fodio. And I've mentioned the Hausa kingdoms, and at the start I mentioned the Hausa Fulani as a joint ethnic group. So I'll explain a bit where that comes from. So that the Hausa are settled people. The Fulani are a major ethnic group all across West Africa. And they were, and still a lot of them are, pastoralists, they're cattle herders. And so they're quite nomadic. But as you get into, I think, as early as the 16th century, some of them start settling in these Hausa kingdoms. And so some are still nomadic, some are settling. And some of them, like Usman Dan Fodio, become quite major Islamic scholars. He publishes over 100 books he's a major teacher, and he's quite a firebrand. He's always castigating the ruling elite of Rhys Harvey Kingdom for being corrupt, not following Islamic practices and all this stuff. And that becomes a problem for him when one of his students actually becomes the ruling emir of Gobir, which is the town he's from, which is right on the north of Nigeria, basically the most northern half of the kingdom. He becomes the ruler of the city, and he knows what Usman Danfodio is like, and he thinks, I can't keep this guy around, he's going to be at my back all the time. So he exiles him, and Usman Danfodio has had enough at this point, so he declares a jihad and calls people to his banners and says, look, we're going to rebel against these Hausa kingdoms, we're going to overthrow them. And he does succeed, and a lot of Fulani go to his banner, but also a lot of the Hausa peasantry do, because at this point they've been massively overtaxed. The Hausa kingdoms have been at war with each other for continuous war for over a century now. To fund these wars, they've been very heavily taxed to peasantry. So a lot of them side with Usman Danfodio. And he successfully conquers all the Hausa kingdoms by 1809, so 5 years after this jihad begins. And that's what he calls it, a jihad. I know that term might be controversial, but that's what he referred to it as, a holy war. That was his thought, but anyway. So you've already had this process of Fulani settling the Hausa kingdoms, but then when you really get Usman Danfodio and his forming the Sokoto Caliphate, which is named after the city of Sokoto, which is formed by his son shortly after he takes over his house, that's when you get a real joining between the Hausa elite and the Fulani elite. And so today, a lot of the time they're referred to in Nigeria as Hausa Fulani, and these are sort of a merged ethnic group. Even though the language is different, they live so closely together and have done for so long a time, a lot of people think they're a merged sort of, count them as one tribal group now. And just to skip forward a bit, the current president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari, is Fulani. And I'm sure you've all heard of Boko Haram. This is a bit of negative, but that's not the major sort of conflict in Nigeria. That's always been, that's died off a bit, but that's always been quite localised very localised to the northeast. The actual major sort of conflict in Nigeria is between Fulani herdsmen and settled farmers, Christian farmers in the middle belt, although it's increasingly going further south. Farmers want to grow crops in this land. The herders want to graze a cat in the land, and there's been a lot of conflict over that, you know. Several thousand people have died in that over the last few years. So it's gotten quite violent. And it's been exacerbated by climate change. Like Chad's a tenth of the size it was 50 years ago, a lot of the tributaries are drying up. So there's less and less farmland and less land to graze your cattle. So forcing people to share the same land, more and more conflict. And also, there's been a lot of migration into Nigeria from Fulani groups outside of Nigeria, French-speaking Fulani groups from Mali and stuff, fleeing the troubles there. So, you know, it's referred to as a herdsman conflict, but not all of them are herdsmen. A lot of them have fled conflict and they don't even have cattle, and they're resulting to banditry instead. So this is one of the major problems in Nigeria today. So if you're reading Nigerian newspapers, you'll see it's mentioned quite a lot. I just thought I'd mention that. So yeah, we've got the Sokoto Caliphate. And I mentioned before that there's not really like a previous like unified polity which makes up modern day Nigeria. The closest you get is the Sokoto Caliphate, because after it's founded by Usman Danfodio, it expands very quickly into modern day Burkina Faso to the west and as far east as Cameroon. And right down south, never conquers oil, but does conquer a lot of the regions around oil and sort of ends the oil empire, severely weakens it by taking away a lot of the tributary city-states. And it expanded using the systems of revolts, which is where we get back to the slave system. Revolts were these forts surrounded by agricultural plantations, which were tended to by slaves. But because it's not racialized in the north, there's quite a fluid dynamic between moving from slave into like freedman. And because it was a Muslim state, they weren't allowed to enslave other Muslims. So a lot of the time, this was sort of, the slavery was like a process of sort of integrating people into Islam, and as they accepted Islam, they'd be freed. Even before they were freed, a lot of them made it quite high up in administration. Again, if you were skilled on these plantations and could manage a farm, you'd be almost become a local governor while still technically being a slave anyway. But so for a while, half the population of the Sokoto Caliphate, which is probably about 10 million people by the time you get to the mid-19th century, were slaves. And some of them are traded across the Sahara, but most of them are actually on these agricultural plantations. So that's the Sokoto Caliphate. Move back to transatlantic slavery now. and it's heavily tied, obviously slavery is heavily tied with trade in general and also religion. Transatlantic slave trade starts in Nigeria, in the Kingdom of Benin, which we talked about previously in the 15th century. It's originally the Portuguese, and they exchange slaves. They buy slaves in exchange for European manufactured goods, normally. Firearms and alcohol are the two big ones. And so this is one of the... there's always this question around Africa of development. Why does it seem to have developed slower than other regions of the world? That's a very complicated question. But one of them is this slave trade process. Is if you're getting all your manufactured goods from abroad, that tends to kill off your local industry. So as you've seen, going back to the Nok civilization, there were skilled iron workers and craftsmen in these countries, in these kingdoms. That starts to decline as it's replaced by manufactured goods manufactured in Europe in exchange for slaves. Benin actually banned the sale of male slaves to Europeans in 1553 because they needed the manpower. They needed it for farming and they needed it for the military. So you know, it's economic reasons. It's not particularly noble, but anyway, but they banned the male. So, and after that, Benin becomes a bit of a refuge. So slaves, if they manage to escape their captors, a lot of the time they'll flee to Benin because they know they won't be sold on to Europeans. There's still an internal slave trade in Benin, but it starts to die off massively after 1553. And the transatlantic slave trade then moved towards places like Lagos, Calabar, which is in the far southeast of the country, Bonny and River States, and Maiduguri, which is further west of Lagos. And the Dutch and the British start to replace the Portuguese. This goes on for a long time until Britain banned slavery in 1807 due to the various reasons. You can get into how cynical you want to be, but a lot of it is the influence of some quite noble abolitionists, some of whom were black, some of whom were freed Nigerian slaves in the United Kingdom. And after they banned the slave trade, they also set up the West African Naval Squadron, which is to intercept slave ships from the other European powers and return these slaves back to Africa. But obviously a lot of slaves have been shipped overseas there. And just a point I want to make sure, something that's not noticed, the slaves maintained a lot of their culture in some places. So on the right-hand side of the screen there, you can see these Anafarunda signals, which are derivative of Entebbede, the written language you've seen previously, but you can find these in places like Cuba. The Apacuja cult in Cuba uses these extensively in their rituals. It's Entebbede, and you can see the similarities, I think. And on the left, I'm just going to play an audio clip, actually, and let me know if you can hear it. This is from Cuba. So yeah, that's in Cuba. You'll also find very similar things in places like Brazil. That's a traditional Yoruba dance. It's a spiritual dance talking about Yemaya, who's Orisha, they're called in Yoruba region. Traditionally, the river Orisha in Cuba become more associated with the oceans, as you can imagine, being an island surrounded by an ocean, so the water spirit. And in Yoruba region, yeah, the Orishas, to praise them, you do certain kinds of traditional dances, wear certain kinds of clothes. You can see the blue clothes, so there's colours associated with the Orisha, and you sing songs. And this is in 2014 in Cuba, still being practiced. Slaves took their culture with them, and some of that still remains today in the Americas, in the Caribbean, places like that. So I'm trying, I think these relationship in the slave trade's more complicated than it just being all going sort of one way and all ending up in sort of slave. So that's one sort of relationship going outwards. But after the British end the slave trade, and even before that, actually, this is something which is really understudied, but I really want to emphasize, because this is, I think, becomes really important as you get towards Nigerian independence and the foundation of the modern Nigerian state, is there's a very significant population of slaves returning from the Americas back to Nigeria. And there's two main groups of these people. There's the Saro people, who are from the Anglosphere world, and most of them are returned to Sierra Leone, and then from there moved back to Nigeria on their own a lot of the time. The first group, who actually founded Freetown in Sierra Leone, which is the capital today, were black American Revolutionary War veterans who fought on the side of the British. And after the British lost the Revolutionary War, they fled to Nova Scotia in Canada. Nova Scotia is very cold and was quite desolate at the time. And they weren't very happy there, and they petitioned the British that, look, we fought for you. We don't want to be in Nova Scotia. Some of us would like to return to Africa. And Britain went along with it and sent them back to Sierra Leone, and they established Freetown, about 1,100 of these Nova Scotian freed slaves. Yeah, and don't want to go on to too much of a tangent into the American Revolutionary War, but it's one of the things that's ignored in that whole, I think, quite ludicrous narrative of American mythos, is that the vast majority of slaves in that war, probably about two-thirds of them, fought for the British and fought through the line of the British because, majorly because the British offered them freedom if they did fight for them. And in some cases, the British made good on that promise. Dwayne The Rock Johnson's descended from not these slaves who returned to Freetown, but from Black American Revolutionary War veterans from Nova Scotia. That's where his dad's lineage goes back to. His dad was a Black Canadian wrestler who was descended from these people, so it's quite interesting. There's two quite famous and important examples of these Sarawak people I'm going to get into more later. There's Bishop Ajayi Crowther, who was the first Anglican bishop in Africa. I've got a picture of him there in the top right. Educated in Oxford in the 1860s, got a master's in divinity from Oxford, he was on a slave ship, was intercepted by the West African squadron and sent back to Sierra Leone. And from there, he got an education at a Christian school, went on to, like I said, become the first Anglican bishop. And there's also J.P. Davis, who was another slave owner, who was a captain of his own ship for a while and becomes quite close friends with Ajayi Crowther, but another freed Sarawak person. And the second major group is the Amaro people, who were freed slaves from Brazil and Cuba. And so these are Catholic, as opposed to most of the Sarawak people become Anglican because of the influence of the church and the missionaries. And you've got the spread of Christianity in the South now, but it's most of the South of Nigeria is still following its traditional spiritual religions. There is missionary work there, but the major population of Christians are these returned people for the most part. The Amaro people, they're freed slaves from Brazil. A lot of them, some of them, they come late in the Sarawak people. Some of the Sarawak people are going back in the very early 1800s. By the mid sort of 19th century, 1850, 1860, you get these Amaro people. A lot of them are paying for their own way back to Nigeria. That's how some of them are sent back from Brazil after they stage like a rebellion in the 1863. About 1,000 of them then get sent back to Nigeria. This is a way of, we're not going to have any more rebellions if we just send them out of the country. And they set up the Brazilian Court in Lagos. This is the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, which is still in Lagos. And you can see maybe Portuguese slash Brazilian architectural style there. And that church is about 150 years old. And so you sort of seen the end of the transatlantic slave trade in the 19th century. It's been sort of dwindled down. But we obviously then move straight into the colonial era. And it begins, Lagos is colonized about 40 years before the rest of the country. And this happens when Oba Atikoi, he becomes the ruler of Lagos, and he tries to ban slavery in 1841. The British have banned slavery at this point, but obviously slave trade has still gone on with the Portuguese well into the 1860s. And also there's still this internal slave trade, which I mentioned before. So there's still slavery in Lagos. He wants to ban it. The merchant class in Lagos, which is, by this point is a very serious trading port, it started as a fishing trade, but very powerful, and they depose him and replace him with, there's been a long sort of royal dispute in lineage at this point, and depose him with his rival, Oba Kosoko. Atikoi, he ends up in exile in Britain, and he begins petitioning the British to reinstate him. The argument he makes is, you want to end slavery, I want to end slavery. And, you know, you help me to do this, I'll make sure that your trade interests are protected. Lord Palmerston is the Prime Minister at the time. He likes the sound of this. And he sends Ajayi Crowther to Queen Victoria to make a direct appeal to her, which is quite powerful, having this person, this returned slave. He reads her the Lord's Prayer in Yoruba, which she says is very melodious. She likes the sound of it. So she's quite impressed with that. And the British agree. And so they send a fleet to Lagos to do what's called the bombarding of Lagos. J.P.L. Davis, who I've mentioned before, he's present. He's serving on one of these ships. A lot of the early Nigerians who live in Britain are sailors. Some of them returned slaves. Some of them were just hired in ports when they were short of sailors in Nigeria. There's a, if you look on the Nelson's Column, in Trafalgar Square, there's a black sailor actually depicted on that column at the bottom. I'm not sure if he's from Nigeria, but anyway, so barely own. And JPL Davies is one of these who's returned slaves serving the British Navy, received a Christian education, and he's wounded. The first assault actually in the when they actually tried to storm Lagos was repulsed. The Oba Kosako had amassed a lot of muskets, a lot more than the British were expecting, and a lot of cannon. He had over 50 cannons on these fortifications around Lagos. Like I said, the slave trade, a lot of what they were training for was weapons. And so he's quite heavily armed at this point. And so the first attempt to storm Lagos fails, but a month later in December, they go back and they succeed, but JPL Davies is wounded. And he notes that he thinks Oba Kosako made a tactical mistake. Oba didn't deploy his own navy. He had war canoes with swivel guns and he didn't send them out. Anyway, so JPL Davies makes it his favor. But anyway, Kosako loses. He's not captured though, he flees. He flees northwards to another Yoruba kingdom where he sort of starts gathering more soldiers and for the next 10 years keeps threatening to invade and take back Lagos, the British ignoring most of it. Until in 1861, the French are starting to make incursions nearby. And they're worried that these two might team up. So Lord Palmerston, in power again, he arranges for the formal annexation of Britain. So it's a formal colony. So in 1861, Lagos becomes a formal colony of Britain under British protection. The French can't invade it and say, we were just, you know, this was a local dispute. You're actually attacking British land here. You might trigger a big war. So, you know, that deters them. So Lagos becomes the first part of Nigeria to be formally colonized. Delta Protectorate is next. I'm going to skip over that, but there's some very interesting stories there. If we go back to Benin now, Benin's still a major city at this point. And it's a thorn in the British side as they start to expand out of Lagos. They set up the Royal Niger Company. People are familiar with the history of India, might be familiar with the East India Company or a West India Company in the Caribbean, but they do colonization through a corporation to start off with. They want to expand outwards from Lagos. Benin's frustrating them. In 1896, they send off an expedition to try and conquer Benin, and they try to do it covertly. They hide their weapons in the luggage of the porters, and they're doing it secretly, but the Oba Benin gets warning of this from people on the coast, they're coming to conquer them. And so he's not sure what to do. And he settles on, let them come here and we sort of hear them out. We'll make sure we're ready if they want to fight. But we'll hear them out. I'm not sure if these rumors are true that they're actually going to invade. His military leaders, though, ignore him and independently of him, attack this expedition and ambush it. And there's only two survivors, two Britishmen survive. And so not only has, but actually, in one of the ironies, not only has the Oba's generals disobeying him, the British hadn't received official leave to actually go and conquer Benin. They just sort of done it on their own. They sent this letter off and not waited for a reply. But now that there's been an ambush of only two survivors, now the British are like, well, we better go take it. Clearly, it's a threat. So the next year, they send 1,200 Marines and they conquer the city. And the city's burnt down. And nobody's sure why or how. But so this city that's been there 1,000 years is burnt down. Is it an accident? Was it deliberate? Who knows? But most of it's burnt down. There's a lot of casualties. Again, nobody actually counted them at the time. And that is the last Oba of Benin. I've got a picture of there. We're getting to 1896 now, so we've got photographs. I think we've got to a point with the British. That system of returned slaves, that's important for the original colonization of Nigeria. And it's important as it moves in and develops. Most of the civil service in the south of Nigeria is made up of returned slaves because obviously they speak European languages. A lot of them are Christian. A lot of them have had an education in European education systems, so they're familiar with European systems. So they become the civil service and they become sort of the middle class, particularly in Lagos and stuff like that, do quite well for themselves. And the traditional rulers, some of them are quite jealous of this, but they say, look, we need to catch them up. So they begin sending their children to education in Britain. And this is when you get another part of the British, the Nigerians in Britain. And so it establishes this really, I'm sure if you've met a Nigerian, you're not so obsessed with education. And this is the foundations of this. And this is where most of the diaspora, the Nigerian diaspora in Bradford comes from. They come here for university to this day. So the Nigerian population in Bradford is, some of it's quite transient. They're here, most of them are here for advanced degrees, masters and PhDs. And when they go out, some settle here, some go on to London, some go back to Nigeria, some go all over the world. Who knows? That's where most of the Nigerians in Bradford come from. My own dad he came actually to Huddersfield for university, but ended up in Bradford for a bit after that. So that's my history here. But there's some other examples of some interesting Nigerians in Bradford. In 1930, he was actually a former captain in the police force in Nigeria, David Osman Odobanja. He fell out with the Anglican Church and decided he wanted to set up another branch. And he ended up coming to Bradford and linking up with the Apostolic Church in Bradford. And this is in 1930. And then after being sort of educated by them here, went back and set up the Christ Apostolic Church in Nigeria. So he founded that and he was taught in Bradford. Well, it's not quite Bradford, but Wallace Soyinka, who's a Nobel laureate in literature, he went to university in Leeds in the 1950s, just across the road. There's an interesting local story of Susanna Nwosa. She was an early Nigerian immigrant to Bradford in the 1940s. She actually met a Bradfordian born in Bradford, Mike Shaw, in Nigeria. He was over there working in one of the factories. He met Susanna, you know, quite fancy. They ended up, you know, talking a bit. They ended up in a romance and they married and he brought her back here. And there's some really interesting, if you want to know a bit more about their story, there's actually a book specifically, if you want to know more specifically about the Nigerian history in Bradford, Nigerian Voices, done by Nigerian Community Association Bradford. You can buy it if you get in contact with them. It's a book and a DVD and it's got Susanna's story in that, along with some other stories of Bradfordians in Nigeria, Nigerians in Bradford, so there's a book and a DVD series if you want more specifically about that, if you get into contact with Nigerian Community Association from Bradford. But yeah, the vast majority are here for university and some for work. Thank you for the talk. Sorry, I've gone way over there.
Thank you so much, Danny.
For questions and, yeah.
I apologise, it's absolutely fine. And the fact you started it way back with some archaeological prehistory is just amazing. I think you've saved us all a trip to the British Museum, and I doubt they had as much as you do.